This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us for hour number two. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about Cuba, and specifically, we'll be talking about the city of Havana. And our guest is a novelist and journalist, Alfredo José Estrada. And we will be talking about a book that he's authored that's just recently been published. The title is Havana, Autobiography of a City. In the book, he points out that Havana certainly is a real place. You can find it on real maps. It's one of the largest cities in Latin America, a metropolis with a population of over 2 million, a very vibrant place. But he also notes that you can easily find Havana on the map of the imagination. And that's the way he writes. It's the first line of his preface. He writes, "Few other cities offer such infinite possibility. There's always been an air of intrigue about the place. As Winston Churchill wrote when he arrived there in 1895, here was a place where anything might happen." Our guest, Alfredo Estrada, was born in Cuba, although he left when he was really too little to remember much about that point of his life. But he has traveled back there a number of times since, and this book is one of the results. He's also the author of the novel Welcome to Havana, Señor Hemingway. It was published in 2005, was well received. He was born in Havana, educated at Harvard, was the founder of Hispanic, an award-winning monthly magazine, and also editor-in-chief of Vista, the largest publication in the U.S. for Latinos. Right now, he's making his home in Austin, Texas, and he's working on writing another novel. He's talking with us by phone about his book, the book about Havana. Questions are certainly welcome as we move here through the hour. All we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief, but of course, anybody can call in if you have a question. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois and Indiana. If you happen to be listening on the internet, actually, you can also use that. As long as you're in the United States, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you have questions, you can give us a call. Mr. Estrada, hello.
Yes, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, thanks. And yourself?
Just fine, thank you.
Well, thanks for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
We appreciate it. You know, something that I think over the years, I've interviewed a few people, a handful of people who have written about Cuba. And I think this is some of the most florid prose I have ever encountered. Something about this place just seems to unhinge people a little bit. What do you think that it is that it has that effect on tourists particularly?
That's why I say that Havana exists on the map of the imagination. Something about Havana infects visitors who go there, and they typically find exactly what they want to find. And this goes back to Christopher Columbus, who thought he was in China when he reached Cuba. And Che Guevara, who wanted to build a socialist utopia in Cuba. Say. And because of that, people often miss the real Havana. And that's what I try to do in my book, to really explore the city on its own terms.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting to think about all of the various influences that have come to the island. It certainly had many occupiers, and so contemporary Cuban culture is a mix of a lot of things. What's interesting to me in looking at your family background is just how that reflects that it's Cuban, it's European. You even, one of your great-grandfathers actually was one of the Rough Riders?
That's right. My mother's family was American. They lived in, my great-grandfather lived in Georgia. And he joined the Rough Riders to impress his future bride, who was a Cuban girl. And then after the war, he married her, and they settled in Havana.
And so you were born in Cuba. How old were you when your family left?
I was 2 years old when we left in 1961. We left 2 years after the Cuban Revolution.
Uh-huh. So what were the circumstances for your family there after the revolution?
Well, my family was middle class. My father was an engineer. He'd studied in the United States at Georgia Tech, and he worked for Shell Oil. And like many Cubans of his generation, they became disenchanted with the direction the revolution was going. It wasn't a communist revolution at the beginning. That came later, and many Cubans refused to accept this, and so left, mostly for the United States.
And then when, for you, what was the first time that you went back?
I went back 30 years later in 1991 as a journalist. I was able to go. Journalists aren't covered by the trade embargo or the travel ban. And I was the editor of a magazine in Washington, D.C. called Hispanic Magazine. And I went, and for me, it was really a process of rediscovering the city where I was born.
Yeah, and you've had an opportunity to spend some significant amount of time there since, off and on, over a number of trips.
That's right. The last time I was there was just under a year ago.
Yeah. You, I'm sure, growing up, heard a lot of stories from parents and relatives, you know, people who were adults at the time that they left Cuba. So you must have, in your mind, had some sort of picture of the place. When you actually went there, how did the Cuba of imagination, the one that would have been the Cuba of the imagination of your parents and people of their generation, how did that square with the real Cuba that you were confronted with when you went there?
Well, some things were much worse than I imagined. Some things were much better. I was struck by the beauty of the city. I was struck by the fact that Havana is one of the most beautiful cities in the world. It's right off the Gulf Stream with a superb natural harbor and unrivaled architecture. There's more Spanish colonial architecture in Havana than anywhere in the Western Hemisphere. I was also impressed in a negative way with the way people lived, you know, and sort of the general sense of fatigue and just tiredness that you see in Cuba, the lack of opportunity, particularly for young people. But the fact that I was hearing this from my parents, it's true of all Americans that we hear about Havana and Cuba is always very politicized from a number of different agendas. That's why it's very important for Americans to form their own conclusions and go to Cuba and try and understand it.
Well, do you think that it is true? I suppose that some people would argue that the policy of the official government policy of the United States has been heavily influenced by Cuban expatriates, people who perhaps like your parents. I don't want to label them that way, but people like your parents who maybe had initially some support for the revolution, maybe not, for whatever reason left and continued to bear a grudge against Fidel Castro and the people that brought about that revolution. And so those folks, Cuban Americans, are the ones that have really driven U.S. policy toward Cuba. And some people have made the argument, and it's not a new one, that it's really been counterproductive, that it hasn't made a whole lot of sense, but that a relatively small number of people were really helping to shape the policy of this very large country toward this other that was so close and yet so far.
But bear in mind that this policy was established by President Eisenhower in 1960. Mm-hmm. He's the one who imposed the travel embargo. This predates the Cuban Revolution. This predates the Cuban exiles in Miami. So it goes beyond that. But there's no question that as this policy progressed into the 90s, it became a way for the Republicans to really control the Cuban vote in Miami. But that's changing. I mean, a lot of the hard line element in Havana and in Miami that you described, these are people now in their 70s and 80s. They're Castro's own generation. The younger generation feels somewhat different. A recent FIU poll in Miami of Cuban Americans show that 55%, that's a majority, favor unlimited travel to Cuba. So I'm not sure where this hardline majority is anymore. I think it's actually in the minority.
Well, I think that's an interesting point. It's something that I certainly had wondered about, and that was how generationally Cuban Americans were thinking about this. And now that we have people who were born, their parents might well have been born in Cuba, but they were born in the United States, and that perhaps would put the stress on the American in Cuban American, whether their attitudes are substantially different than those of their parents.
Well, I think they are. And I think in two important respects. One is people of my generation and younger, while I don't think there's any support for Castro by any stretch of the imagination, they do understand it's important to engage Cuba, because in the future there will be relations between Cuba and the United States. That's inevitable, and we need to start thinking about that. Second, I don't think in my generation there's much expectation that we'll be able to go back and reclaim properties that were left behind by our parents' generation. I think that's a fantasy. 50 years have passed, and in many cases these properties simply don't exist anymore. So I think we've abandoned that illusion.
Yeah. Recently here, with now that Mr. Castro has essentially been out of public life because of his health, that has certainly touched off an intense wave of speculation about what happens when Castro is gone. Now that, of course, is not really a new question. I suppose people have been asking that one for a long time and speculating about how things might change. Would they change? Would they not? What I'm wondering particularly was whether you have any sense about whether people in Cuba spend a lot of time talking about that too, and whether there is a feeling there that they are at, they're perhaps near an important kind of historical turning point, that in there's no saying exactly how it's going to play out or what's going to happen, but there is at least a sense that they are close to an important change point.
Absolutely. First, that's all they talk about in Cuba now, because for the last 9 months, Cuba's been in a state of suspended animation, and the Cubans know as little as we do. Fidel Castro's health is a state secret, so nobody knows. But I think a couple important points are clear. Regardless of Castro's health, I think it's clear that the era of Fidel Castro is over. Even if Fidel Castro regains his health and returns, which he just might. He's the original comeback kid, remember. Even if he does, I don't know that he'll ever rule Cuba the way he did before. And it's also put a lie to an illusion that U.S. policymakers have had over the years, that once Castro goes, the entire revolution and Cuba itself would implode. The reality is that his brother Raul has been running the country for the last 9 months, and without Fidel Castro. So this idea that as soon as the Castro disappears, Cuba will vanish from the face of the earth and immediately become a democracy, it's just not true. And I think that this experience the last 9 months has proven that.
Let me introduce again the guest we're talking this morning with, Alfredo Jose Estrada. He is a novelist and journalist. He's author of the novel Welcome to Havana, Senor Hemingway, and he's also the founder of Hispanic, an award-winning monthly magazine, and editor-in-chief of Vista, the largest publication in the U.S. for Latinos. He makes his home now in Austin, Texas. He's working on a second novel and has authored a book that's about Cuba and about Havana. The title of the book is Havana, Autobiography of a City, and it's published by Palgrave Macmillan. It's out now, and it's about some of his experiences. As he mentioned, he was born in Cuba, but he left when he was very little and didn't really encounter it again as an adult until something like 30 years after he had left, and has visited a number of times since and has written about it as a journalist. And this book is one of the results. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I thought maybe one way that we could do this conversation, when we could talk about Cuba and Havana and the place that it is to talk a little bit about the various influences that have helped to make the culture what it is, starting with the culture of the indigenous people. And if you're in Cuba today or if you're in Havana today, are there things that you see, things about the place that you can trace back to the original people, the Taino Indians, the people that were there when Columbus showed up?
Sadly enough, very little. And that's an episode of Cuban history that's been obscured, because the original conquest of Cuba was a genocide. I mean, there were as many as perhaps a million of the Taino Indians living in Cuba and throughout the Caribbean, in Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic, and Jamaica. And they were, for the most part, wiped out within a generation by disease and also simply by overwork. I mean, the Spaniards tried to enslave the population and literally wipe them out. So very little is left of the Taino Indians, and it was a thriving civilization that had been there for thousands of years. Certain words are all we have left. Words like hurricane and hammock and barbecue all come from the Taino. And, of course, the Tainos introduced various things to Europe through the agriculture, things like the cultivation of sweet potatoes and pineapples and things like that Columbus brought back with him. And, of course, tobacco. The Tainos were the first tobacco smokers that Columbus encountered. That's all we have left of the Tainos, sadly enough.
And then I suppose the next biggest wave and the thing that's going to be very important is obviously European influence, particularly Spanish.
Well, and that's the largest single influence in Cuba. Of course, the Havana was founded by conquistadors in 1519, and the reason Havana grew to become one of the most important cities in the New World was that it was the stopping off point for the Spanish galleons bringing the gold from Mexico and Peru back to Spain. So Havana became the harbor of the Spanish treasure fleet and grew to become one of the most fortified cities in the world because there was the focus of a lot of pirate attacks. Francis Drake nearly attacked the city in 1586, and that accounted for a lot of Havana's growth. Later, the British invaded and took Havana in 1762. They gave it back within a year in exchange for Florida. That's how the British got their hands on Florida. And later, slavery was introduced in big numbers with the cultivation of sugarcane.
And certainly, it is African culture has been important in shaping the culture of Cuba.
Well, people don't often realize that slavery began much later in Cuba. It really didn't begin till the beginning of the 1800s. That's when slaves were introduced to Cuba in big numbers. And that's when the cultivation of sugarcane really began to dominate the Cuban industry. And of course, all throughout the 19th century, the slave trade becomes very important in Cuba. And you can see that culturally, and not just in the music, but in the religion, which is Santeria, which is a mixture of the Catholic religion and the Yoruban religion of the slaves. And that's a very important part of Cuban culture.
Yeah. Just one more thing to round this out, and that is certainly there would have been an important period where there would have been important influence from the United States. Since the Revolution, it's been difficult, not impossible, but difficult to go there. But it is, after all, only 90 miles away. If people think about Cuba, one of the things that they're certainly going to think about is the period when that was a tropical American playground.
Well, the relationship with the United States goes much further back than that. Five U.S. presidents, beginning with Thomas Jefferson, tried to buy Cuba outright from Spain. Cuba was always seen as strategically very important to the United States. Of course, after the so-called Spanish-American War, because in Cuba they call it the War of Independence, and that's what it was really about, more than between Spain and the United States. The United States became politically, economically very, very, very important in Cuba. And I think American visitors to Havana and to Cuba will really be amazed by how much they recognize that it's familiar. There's a tremendous amount of ties between Cuba and the United States that really transcend politics.
We have a caller we'll bring in here right at this point. Other people who are listening, by the way, can call 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller here where we are in Champaign County. This is Line 1. Hello.
Hi. As you're talking in rather broad strokes, I thought I'm really interested in the city itself and your story of it, and it's curious that it was awarded a prize by UNESCO for being a major green city, despite the fact that tourists don't see that part of it, but it produces a lot of urban food, which is a little different for people to think of. Maybe there are peasants.
That's very interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, this was a couple years ago. But what I wanted to get at was the more hemispheric implications, and you were talking about them some, and as far as it just seems to me that the whole argument is changing. Neoliberalism is being questioned everywhere around the world, and particularly in Latin America. There's a forum this weekend called The Resurgence of Populism and Socialism in Latin America, and it just seems, I don't think one can say that the Cubans are instigating this. They are sending doctors to different places, and maybe they're giving a model of spending more of their GDP on healthcare than other countries in the same categories. But it seems to me mainly it's a dissatisfaction with U.S. policy. It can't be attributed to any kind of malfeasance by Castro and crew. But it does change the whole argument when, and I'm sure that young Cubans and young Cuban Americans are having to be sensitive to this too. It's a rather complicated story, I'm sure, but I just wanted to see how you'd react to that.
Well, I think, remember, Hugo Chavez is, Venezuela is now the standard bearer for that. He's sort of taken the torch from Fidel. But Cuban Fidel Castro has always been a symbol of anti-Americanism now, going back 50 years. And so, this resurgence of populism, I think, is a good way to describe it. Has a lot to do with attitudes towards the U.S. I think the U.S. image in Latin America now is as low as it's been since the Cold War. A terrible image in Latin America. We're perceived as being only interested in drug interdiction, and that's it. You know, and because of that, you see much more interest in Cuba and Venezuela, countries like Argentina, for example. Where Hugo Chavez is very popular now.
Wonder how it'd been different if Fidel had been signed up for the Yankees when he came out the first time to the U.S.
That's a myth. That's
I think
a
there
myth.
Would have been somebody else to rise to the occasion.
That's that's a myth, you know, because Castro was actually a basketball player in high school. But he was a talented high school athlete. But that's it. He was never. I mean, Cuba has a tremendous baseball culture and. You know, going back to the 1860s, you know, so Fidel was not quite major league material. That's a myth that was spread probably by Fidel himself.
this is another bit of a digression, and I'll hang up after this, but there's a lot. You were involved in founding a journal called Hispanic
Magazine.
Hispanic. I mean, I don't know what year that was, but there's always been this contestation about what we call ourselves and what certain groups of people and people that, I mean, it's not a matter of political correctness. It's how one sees oneself. But that was always a rather contested name. And I'm just wondering how it happened that you choose the name, or you were associated with people that funded it, or.
Well, I started that magazine myself, you know. But I mean, Hispanics refer to themselves as a number of names, whether Hispanic or Latino or Chicano or Mexican American or Puerto Rican American. It runs the whole gamut, you know. So it's all describing the same thing, which is the U.S. Hispanic community. Hispanics living in this country, often born in this country, and retaining some interest in their native culture. That's all. We didn't attach any significance to the name. There are many many issues. Much important than Hispanics and you know the label that we choose for ourselves.
Well, it does cover over so much variety, so much amazing variety, and that's I don't know. I guess it's a challenge. Thanks.
All right. Well, we're here at about our midpoint of this part of Focus 580, talking with Alfredo Jose Estrada. He's a journalist and a novelist. His novel, Welcome to Havana, Senor Hemingway, was published in 2005 and was well received. He is the author of a new book that's a nonfiction work. It's a work of journalism. It's titled Havana, Autobiography of a City. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan. He was born in Havana, educated at Harvard, was the founder, as he had mentioned, of Hispanic, a monthly magazine, and also editor-in-chief of Vista, the largest publication in the U.S. for Latinos. Right now he makes his home in Austin, Texas. He's working on another novel. And questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Did you, for you, in coming to know Cuba after you had, as you said, you'd been born there, but when you were little, your parents had left and it was 30 years before you came back. In coming to know this place, did for you, was this something of an exercise in coming to know yourself? Did in coming to get some sort of understanding about Cuba and Havana, did you come away feeling that maybe you understood yourself, your family, and your background better than you had before?
Oh, I think absolutely. I think that's true of every American rediscovering his or her roots, but particularly for Cuban Americans. I mean, Cuban Americans are very independent people, and for many of them, leaving Cuba meant really divorcing themselves from their heritage and their history and their culture. And many Cuban Americans have forgotten a lot of Cuban history, and really focused just on what happened after 1959. And what I tried to bring out in my book is the panorama of Cuban history, which goes back more than 500 years and is a fascinating history. Cuba is incredibly diverse culturally. I mean, we've talked about the Taino Indians and the Spaniards. There was a tremendous Chinese migration, you know, in the 19th century. Many Chinese were brought to work in the sugarcane fields, and that's an important part of Cuban culture. The French A number of French people left after the revolt in Haiti in 1789 and went to Havana. They really started the coffee industry in Cuba. So you see these cultural ties that are fascinating.
We have somebody here on cell phone. We'll go there, line four. Hello.
Oh, yes. Maybe I missed this, but I've spent the past 2 years working heavily in the Miami area, and I was there for a huge celebration about the illness of Fidel Castro. And I was just kind of wondering, I mean, people were in the streets and having just such a great time. What was the local reaction? Because we don't see that in the United States.
The reaction in Havana?
Yes.
Well, people are very anxious, and they're very wary of the future. I mean, Cuba for the last 9 months has been in a state of suspended animation because they know as little as we do. I mean, it's a state secret, so Cubans themselves don't know what's going to happen. I think they're hopeful of the future. They see the possibility of a more open society after Fidel Castro goes. But they know it won't happen right away. So while people are, I think, hopeful, they're also very wary.
Okay. I didn't know if it was a jubilation or do you feel that once a newer government might be established that we'll see the Cuban Americans leaving and heading home to Cuba or?
Oh, absolutely not. I don't think so because again, it's been 50 years. And the generation that left Cuba behind are people now in their 70s and 80s. And the Cuba they remember no longer exists. And many of these people who left their homes, well, those homes may not exist anymore. And they've made a life here. So I don't think you'll see a mass migration back to Cuba. I think ultimately you'll see a lot of Cuban Americans wanting to do business in Cuba, establishing ties with their family again. And I see a lot of cultural ties as well. But I don't think you'll see people moving back to reclaim what was once theirs.
Well, it sounds like it'll be great. So thank you for asking my question.
Right.
Have a great day.
Well, thanks for the call. I do recall, as the caller said, when the news of Fidel Castro's illness became public, that there were people in Miami who were dancing in the streets thinking that he was going to die. And I guess that what that tells you is something about the symbolic significance of this man for the people who left and who opposed him. And also you can see the same thing happening in a sort of different way for the Cuban people because he has been so much the focus of Cuban identity, Cuban nationalism, Cuban pride in its resistance to what they would see as the interference of the United States in Cuban affairs. So it seems that for a lot of people, he himself represents in a personal kind of way either what people think is wrong with Cuba or what people think is right with Cuba. And it seems almost too much for any one individual really to bear.
If anyone can do it, Fidel Castro can. I mean, regardless of what you think of the individual, and he has few supporters in the world these days. I mean, Fidel Castro has lost much of what credibility he once had among the intelligentsia. He's certainly one of the most memorable figures of the 20th century.
Yeah, for other people in Cuban history. Is there anybody else, Martí maybe would be one figure, who has that kind of significance, that kind of symbolic significance? Is there anyone to rival Castro in the history of Cuba?
Well, José Martí is a towering figure in Cuba. He's the father of Cuban independence. He's often called the apostle of freedom. And he's an individual that Americans don't know enough about. And actually, Martí lived most of his life in the United States. He was exiled from Cuba at a very young age, and he lived most of his life in New York. And he was one of the first people to write about the United States for a Latin American audience. In addition to his revolutionary activities, he was a poet and a journalist, and he wrote for a number of Latin American papers about the Gilded Age in New York. So he's a fascinating figure. But Martí is a very important symbol in Cuba because it links together the past and the future. I mean, Castro has always used Martí as a symbol, but Martí himself would not approve of communism in Cuba. Probably the most important thing to Martí was self-expression. And I think Martí would very quickly run afoul of the present regime in Cuba.
You talked about the fact that really, if you talk about the essence of policy, U.S. policy toward Cuba, you actually have to go back a significant way to all the way back to Dwight Eisenhower. But certainly this Cuban-American relations heavily influenced by the Cold War, obviously, and by American concerns about communism. Would there have been some point, always, I guess when we talk about history, you always love to ask these kinds of what-if kinds of questions, but would there have been some point where things could have gone in a different direction, and if that had happened, that we might have seen a substantially different relationship all these years now between Cuba and the United States?
Well, John F. Kennedy, right before his assassination, was actually working to restore relations with Cuba. Most Kennedy scholars agree that that was an objective of his, and he saw that as a big mistake, and he wanted to set that right. So things could very well have changed very quickly. But moving forward, at various times, U.S. administration has tried to undo the embargo and establish relations. This goes back to Nixon and Kissinger, but primarily Carter and Clinton. And at each stage of the game, Cuba has shut the door. So it's not fair to say that it's simply the U.S. that hasn't wanted to establish Cuba. For the most part, the embargo has helped Fidel Castro. It's allowed him to blame all of Cuba's ills, all of Cuba's economic ills, on the embargo, which just isn't true. So Fidel Castro has never been willing to see the embargo drop. It's actually helped them quite a bit.
Yeah. Well, I suppose, yeah, that does. You can make the argument that sometimes it helps to have a powerful enemy, because it's one thing that can help develop cohesion, a sense that we're all of us together, we're engaged in this common struggle against this big, powerful enemy, and I guess they don't get too much more bigger and more powerful than the United States.
And that rhetoric has always been a standard part of Fidel's four-hour speeches to the Cuban public, that everything that is wrong with Cuba is to be blamed on the embargo.
Maybe you could talk, since this book is specifically, it is really, in a sense, it's a compact history of Cuba, but it's focused very specifically on Havana. Talk a little bit more about the city, its spirit, its feeling, and I suppose that when you do that, you really have to acknowledge the fact that it is, in some ways, not just one city, it is several, at least when you think about the oldest part, Old Havana, you think about the European Spanish influence, you think about the way that it was shaped by people who came in there and built big hotels after in the period of the 30s and the 40s, and has continued to benefit by tourism, the extent that if Americans have a hard time getting here, Europeans and other people from Latin America don't. Talk about the place and the feel of the place.
I like to think of Havana as a time machine. If you begin in what they call the Plaza de la Revolución, where Castro would give his famous speeches, and you walk east, in a few blocks you come to what they call Centro Havana, which is the downtown, and that most of that was built in the early 20th century, and that's where Hemingway used to hang out, in the Floridita Bar. And the old Cuban Congress is there. Then if you keep going east a few more blocks, you enter Havana Vieja, Old Havana, the Plaza de Armas. This is where Havana was founded in 1519 by conquistadors. So Havana, more than any other city, tells its own history through its neighborhoods, through the barrios, as they call them, like very few cities in the world.
Well, let's talk with some other people here. We'll go to Crete, Illinois. This is line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, they don't have bullfights, do they, in Havana?
They used to have bullfights. They used to have bullfights until the Spanish-American War, at which point the American authorities banned bullfighting because it was sort of more identified with the Spaniards than baseball, and they promoted baseball. So, but there had been bullfighting in Havana up until 1898.
I'd like to ask you a couple of questions. One regards the mafia, La Cosa Nostra, in Havana in the 40s and 50s especially, Santo Traficante and Jack Ruby and some of the other boys, Maya Lansky. And then I'd like to ask you what you think about the proposition or thesis or conspiracy idea that Castro or the anti-Castro Cubans had something to do with the death of John F. Kennedy.
Oh my goodness! Well, the mobsters were very visible in Havana in the 1950s. That's been somewhat exaggerated though, because they were really there only a few years. That began with Batista after 1953. The mob had not been in Havana in any significant way in the 30s and 40s. I mean, Al Capone at one point tried to establish a beachhead there in the 1920s and was chased out because Cuba was a pretty rough place. So they tend to exaggerate that somewhat, and that's kind of the image you see of Havana. Havana was a very big city, and that part of Havana was just one small part of it. Now, as far as the conspiracy theory goes, who can say? Because a number of the individuals that were involved in the Bay of Pigs was seen as a tremendous betrayal by John F. Kennedy. So they might well have been involved in that conspiratorial soup.
So you think only about 6 years of mob influence was there in Cuba?
Absolutely. The mob, in terms of these hotels like the Hotel Riviera and so forth, that only really began in the 1950s. It really wasn't very prevalent before then. And my point is the image that we often have of Havana in the 1950s is from the movie The Godfather 2. And that was just a part of Havana. That certainly wasn't all of Havana, and it certainly didn't define the city. So I think that tends to be exaggerated somewhat in the public eye.
Of course, Castro used that in his anti-American tirades.
Absolutely, but interestingly enough, after the revolution, Castro did not want to get rid of the casinos. Castro wanted to keep the casinos, and he wanted to continue tourism. But once his policy shifted towards a very anti-American focus, tourists stopped coming, and that's why the casinos went out of business. But after the revolution, Castro, you know, wanted to keep the casinos going.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And we'll go on here to caller on line number one, someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was wondering if the guest could comment on the status of Cuban education, primary, secondary education, and maybe the effects of the embargo on that.
Well, the education has always been seen as one of the great achievements of the revolution, and certainly one of Castro's initial achievements was eliminating much of the illiteracy that existed in the Cuban countryside. So that's a very positive thing. Cuba has a very well-educated populace, and at some point in the future, that's going to be very significant. Cuba's positioning itself now as a possible source for outsourcing, particularly in the IT area. So that's something that may be a possibility. I think the question is, though, what opportunities is this education creating for Cubans today? In Havana, you see physicists who make more money as waiters in restaurants, and civil engineers who make more money driving cabs. So the real question is, you know, has this education provided opportunities for Cubans? I'm afraid it hasn't. But it's a very well-educated population, very very culturally aware, and very very culturally vibrant as well.
The little research I've done always goes back to how everything could be better if there wasn't an embargo. Do you think that's true?
Well, my opinion is that the best way to engage Cuba is not by sending the best way to change Cuba is not by sending the Marines, but sending in McDonald's. I mean, that's what really will help democratize Cuba is make Cubans aware of what life is like in the United States. You know, so I think the embargo has a very negative effect of isolating Cuba. If you look at the embargo as a tool to overthrow Castro, it hasn't worked. It hasn't worked for 50 years, so maybe it's time to try something new. That's my point of view.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. I'm sure you were talking maybe only half-jokingly about sending in McDonald's instead of sending in the Marines. I think that probably for a lot of people, Americans maybe, and maybe they're Americans who aren't Cuban-Americans, they're the idea that Cuba opening up it might not necessarily be a good thing if what happens is that Cuba becomes simply an extension of South Florida, that it just that it loses what has made it special and unique. And I think that worries people, some people, and that's one of the things I think perhaps that makes it attractive for some Americans to go, because they have this sense that they better go because things could change, and then it'll be a completely different place. And that's something I wonder what Cubans think about, you know, when they think about how they would like the country to develop and how they perhaps would like it to be a different place than it is today.
The reality is that South Florida is now an extension of Cuba. I mean, nobody speaks English in South Florida anymore. So I don't know if there's any danger of it working the other way around. But there will be tremendous changes in Cuba, and there's no question there will be the economic ties between Cuba and all the United States, not just Miami. And I think Cubans are concerned. I don't think most Cubans would want Cuba to go the way of Miami in the sense of this consumer culture totally overwhelming, because that's what Miami is like. It's all condos and advertising. I don't think that'll happen in Havana. I think there's a life and a spirit to Havana. Havana is one of the great cities of the world. Culturally, in terms of the music, the art, the literature, the poetry, this is not a resort. Miami Beach was a resort that started about 100 years ago, and that's it. Havana is one of the great cities of the world.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and I should introduce again our guest, Alfredo Jose Estrada. He's the author of the novel Welcome to Havana, Senor Hemingway. He is a journalist. He was born in Havana, educated at Harvard. He was the founder of Hispanic, an award-winning monthly magazine, and editor-in-chief of Vista, the largest publication in the U.S. for Latinos. Right now he makes his home in Austin, Texas. He's writing another novel, and I think that one also is set in Cuba.
Well, my first novel, Welcome to Havana, Senor Hemingway, is a historical novel about Cuba in the 1930s. And Ernest Hemingway, that's when he began to go to Cuba in 1932 and so forth. I'm updating that a bit. And so this novel is not about Hemingway, but it is about Cuba in the 1950s and 60s and the revolution and beyond. So it's something that takes the Cuban Revolution up to the present day.
And do you have some sort of a timeline for when you think that might actually reach the hands of readers?
Yeah, I think it should be published probably possibly by the end of next year,
all right,
by the end of 2008.
He's also author of this book that we've mentioned a couple of times, Havana, Autobiography of a City, and it's published by Palgrave Macmillan. And that is it's nonfiction, it's a work of journalism, a history of the city of Havana and also of Cuba. 333-9455 is the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, we do also have a toll-free line good to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Would it be possible to pick some place in the city again to talk a little bit about some place that you just feel that somehow embodies the spirit of the feeling of Cuba and the most habanero kind of place that you can think of in the city of Havana?
One of my favorite places is the Plaza de San Francisco. That's in old Havana, which we call Havana Vieja, and it's just a couple blocks away from the Plaza de Armas, which is the main square of old Havana there. The Plaza de San Francisco is a square where the Spanish galleons once docked. And there's this wonderful customs house that was built in the 1920s there, this sort of Mediterranean Revival customs house. And there's a wonderful church there, the Church of San Francisco de Assis, very, very atmospheric. And, of course, that's Hemingway country. That's where Hemingway is boat docked in the 1930s. And that's where a very famous scene in his novel, To Have and Have Not, was set in that square. So, to me, that's one of the most atmospheric places in Havana. It's also one of the oldest squares. It was laid out in 1579, so that indicates the kind of history that you find in Havana wherever you go.
One of the things that tourists are interested in when they go to Havana is to see Hemingway related stuff. And he did have a house there, the Finca. I do recall within the last couple of years reading that there was real concern about the condition of the place, that essentially it was falling apart, and that there was maybe some effort or some interest in trying to preserve it, but there were questions about exactly how that would be done and where the money would come from. Is that something that you can talk about?
That shows you one of the problems caused by the embargo. There are a number of U.S. foundations, including Hemingway's family and so forth, who wanted to donate money to renovate this house, which is actually the only place, one of the few places outside of the United States on the National Register of Historic Places. There's a treasure trove of Hemingway manuscripts and photographs and you know, in the basement of that house, and there's real danger that some of that will be damaged, and because of the embargo, it's been very difficult to get resources to renovate this house. There's some renovation efforts underway right now, but that's just outside of Havana. That'll be Cuba's greatest tourist attraction. But throughout Havana, you can see where Hemingway drank, where he docked his boat, where the hotel where he stayed. There's a Hemingway trail, and Hemingway is Cuba's best loved writer in any language. He had a tremendous affection for Cubans. He lived there longer than any place else. He lived there more than 20 years. And Cubans return this affection. There's a tremendous empathy for Ernest Hemingway. And to my mind, he's a symbol of what Cubans and Americans share in common. There's a bond there that goes beyond the disagreements of our governments and that we'll see again in the future.
He's certainly, I'm not necessarily clear why people are attracted to him other than the fact that he is a very, an outsized, larger-than-life character and someone who really seems to embody what we think of as being a writer in the kind of romantic heroic sense. So, you know, for all of those reasons, and also for his connection with his exotic place, that is why people are so interested in him, and particularly his connections with Cuba.
And I think that the things that Cubans like about Hemingway are the things they like about the United States. Hemingway's sense of bravado, his independence, his style, his open-heartedness. That's what Cubans like about America.
So you think that within our lifetimes that we'll see the end of the embargo?
Well, I think we could see it fairly soon. There are a number of bills before Congress now to drop the travel ban. I think that would be the first step, and I think a Democratic Congress might well move in that direction, if not for all Americans, at least for Cuban Americans, because President Bush put forth a number of regulations that severely limit travel by Cuban Americans. Now, if you're a Cuban American, you can only visit your direct family once every 3 years. So it's outrageous, and you can only send up to $1,200 per year to your families. Those may well be dropped. And certainly under a new administration, an American president might be willing to take a fresh look at Cuba and start dismantling the embargo. It won't happen all at once, but certainly I think the travel ban is one thing that might go rather quickly. There's absolutely no justification for Americans not to go to Cuba. We can go to places like Iran and even North Korea, I think, but not Havana. That makes no sense.
And so you think significant numbers of Cubans would go, not as an earlier caller suggested, that they would go back to live again, but there are lots and lots of Cuban Americans who would travel to the island to, again, go back to places where they had been, maybe reestablish contact with family because they still feel that they have this connection.
Well, to visit their families. Yeah. Under present U.S. law now, if your parent dies, you better hope that you went less than 3 years ago, because you won't be able to go for another 3 years to visit your ailing parent. I mean, that's something that's draconian. It's at a very negative impact on Cuban families. There's no justification for this politically. It makes no sense.
And are there also a lot of people who think about the possibility that if they could, they would want to invest money in Cuba?
I think so, yeah. I think much of Cuba will need to be rebuilt. I think much of the Cuban infrastructure has been destroyed in the last 50 years. Roads will need to be built. Communication lines, fiber optic cables, you name it. Cuba will be brought into the 21st century. There'll be a tremendous amount of business in Cuba. Possibly the most lucrative is the oil industry. There are about 6 billion barrels of oil beneath coastal waters in the Gulf of Mexico. And that's beginning to be exploited now by Chinese and Indian state-owned enterprises. U.S. oil companies would love to get their hands on that.
Mm-hmm. So you think that if more Americans actually had some direct experience with Cuba, that would go some way to changing the larger policy? If, for example, the first thing that the United States government does is say, okay, if you're an American citizen, you want to go to Cuba, that's fine. We get rid of the travel ban first. That if that happened and that there was a little bit more contact back and forth, and that more Americans, whether they're Cuban Americans or not, had some got to know the place, that would actually go some way to, in a larger sense, changing American policy?
Well, I certainly think it would, because one danger of our policy now, in our efforts to isolate Cuba, we've isolated ourselves from Cuba. American policymakers now literally have no idea what's happening in Cuba. We have absolutely no intelligence whatsoever. And this transition that's taking place in Havana, it's a very delicate transition, and it's potentially a dangerous transition. The U.S. really has no influence or leverage whatsoever in this process, and that's difficult because whatever happens in Cuba will impact on the United States, particularly South Florida. On the other side of the coin, the fact that Americans can go to Cuba, that will really put the lie to all the propaganda that the Cuban government puts out about Americans. I mean, to hear the Cuban government talk about America, you know, it's this imperialistic criminal regime and so forth. Well, that's not what America is all about. And I think Cubans will see that when they meet ordinary Americans coming to visit their country. So I think it works both ways.
Well, there we must stop because we've come to the end of the time. If you're interested in reading about Cuba, this would be a book that you could look at. It's recently been published by our guest, Alfredo Jose Estrada. His title is Havana, Autobiography of a City, published by Palgrave Macmillan. You might also look at his novel. It was published in 2005, Welcome to Havana, Senor Hemingway. And Mr. Estrada, thanks very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.